Chapter 51. Moving on, it is a long vacation in the regions of Chancery Lane. The good ships Law and Equity, those teak-built, copper-bottomed, iron-fastened, brazen-faced, and not by any means fast-sailing clippers are laid up in ordinary. The Flying Dutchman, with a crew of ghostly clients imploring all whom they may encounter to peruse their papers, has drifted, for the time being, heaven knows where. The courts are all shut up. The public offices lie in a hot sleep. Westminster Hall itself is a shady solitude where nightingales might sing, and a tenderer class of suitors than is usually found there walk. The Temple, Chancery Lane, Sergeant's Inn, and Lincoln's Inn, even unto the fields, are like tidal harbors at low water, where stranded proceedings, offices at anchor, idle clerks lounging on lopsided stools that will not recover their perpendicular until the current of term sets in, lie high and dry upon the ewes of the long vacation. Outer doors of chambers are shut up by the score, messages, and parcels are to be left at the porter's lodge by the bushel. A crop of grass would grow in the chinks of the stone pavement outside Lincoln's Inn Hall, but that the ticket porters, who have nothing to do beyond sitting in the shade there, with their white aprons over their heads, to keep the flies off, grub it up, and eat it thoughtfully. There is only one judge in town. Even he only comes twice a week to sit in chambers. If the country folks of those assize towns on his circuit could see him now. No full-bottomed wig, no red petticoats, no fur, no javelin men, no white wands. Merely a close-shaved gentleman in white trousers and a white hat, with sea bronze on the judicial countenance, and a strip of bark peeled by the solar rays from the judicial nose, who calls in at the shellfish shop as he comes along and drinks iced ginger beer. The Bar of England is scattered over the face of the earth. How England can get on through 4 long summer months without its bar, which is its acknowledged refuge in adversity, and its only legitimate triumph in prosperity, is beside the question. Assuredly that shield and buckler of Britannia are not in present wear. The learned gentleman who is always so tremendously indignant at the unprecedented outrage committed on the feelings of his client by the opposite party, that he never seems likely to recover it, is doing infinitely better than might be expected in Switzerland. The learned gentleman who does the withering business, and who blights all opponents with his gloomy sarcasm, is as merry as a grig at a French watering place. The learned gentleman who weeps by the pint on the smallest provocation has not shed a tear these 6 weeks. The very learned gentleman who has cooled the natural heat of his gingery complexion in pools and fountains of law until he has become great in knotty arguments for term time, when he poses the drowsy bench with legal chaff, inexplicable to the uninitiated, and to most of the initiated too, is roaming, with a characteristic delight in aridity and dust, about Constantinople. Other dispersed fragments of the same great palladium are to be found on the canals of Venice, at the second cataract of the Nile, in the baths of Germany, and sprinkled on the sea sand all over the English coast. Scarcely one is to be encountered in the deserted region of Chancery Lane. If such a lonely member of the bar do flit across the waste, and come upon a prowling suitor who is unable to leave off haunting the scenes of his anxiety, they frighten one another, and retreat into opposite shades. It is the hottest long vacation known for many years. All the young clerks are madly in love, and according to their various degrees, pine for bliss with the beloved object, at Margate, Ramsgate, or Gravesend. All the middle-aged clerks think their families too large. All the unknown dogs who stray into the inns of court and pant about staircases and other dry places seeking water give short howls of aggravation. All the blind men's dogs in the streets draw their masters against pumps or trip them over buckets. A shop with a sun blind and a watered pavement and a bowl of gold and silver fish in the window is a sanctuary. Temple Bar gets so hot that it is, to the adjacent Strand and Fleet Street, what a heater is in an urn, and keeps them simmering all night. There are offices about the Inns of Court in which a man might be cool, if any coolness were worth purchasing at such a price in dullness. But the little thoroughfares immediately outside those retirements seem to blaze. In Mr. Crook's court, it is so hot that the people turn their houses inside out, and sit in chairs upon the pavement, Mr. Crook included, who there pursues his studies, with his cat, who never is too hot, by his side. The Soul's Arms has discontinued the harmonic meetings for the season, and Little Swills is engaged at the pastoral gardens down the river, where he comes out in quite an innocent manner, and sings comic ditties of a juvenile complexion calculated, as the bill says, not to wound the feelings of the most fastidious mind. Over all the legal neighborhood there hangs, like some great veil of rust or gigantic cobweb, the idleness and pensiveness of the long vacation. Mr. Snagsby, law stationer of Cook's Court, Cursitor Street, is sensible of the influence, not only in his mind as a sympathetic and contemplative man, but also in his business as a law stationer aforesaid. He has more leisure for musing in Staple Inn, and in the Rolls Yard during the long vacation than at other seasons, and he says to the two prentices, what a thing it is in such hot weather to think that you live in an island with the sea a-rolling, and a-bowling right round you. Guster is busy in the little drawing room on this present afternoon in the long vacation, when Mr. and Mrs. Snagsby have it in contemplation to receive company. The expected guests are rather select than numerous, being Mr. and Mrs. Chadband and no more. From Mr. Chadband's being much given to describe himself, both verbally and in writing, as a vessel, he is occasionally mistaken by strangers for a gentleman connected with navigation, but he is, as he expresses it, in the ministry. Mr. Chadband is attached to no particular denomination, and is considered by his persecutors to have nothing so very remarkable to say on the greatest of subjects, as to render his volunteering, on his own account, at all incumbent on his conscience. But he has his followers, and Mrs. Snagsby is of the number. Mrs. Snagsby has but recently taken a passage upward by the vessel, Chadband, and her attention was attracted to that bark A1, when she was something flushed by the hot weather. My little woman, says Mr. Snagsby to the sparrows in Staple Inn, likes to have her religion rather sharp, you see. So Guster, much impressed by regarding herself for the time as the handmaid of Chadband, whom she knows to be endowed with the gift of holding forth for 4 hours at a stretch, prepares the little drawing room for tea. All the furniture is shaken and dusted, the portraits of Mr. and Mrs. Snagsby are touched up with a wet cloth, the best tea service is set forth, and there is excellent provision made of dainty new bread, crusty twists, cool fresh butter, thin slices of ham, tongue, and German sausage, and delicate little rows of anchovies nestling in parsley, not to mention new-laid eggs, to be brought up warm in a napkin, and hot buttered toast. For Chadband is rather a consuming vessel, the persecutors say a gorging vessel, and can wield such weapons of the flesh as a knife and fork remarkably well. Mr. Snagsby in his best coat, looking at all the preparations, when they are completed and coughing his cough of deference behind his hand, says to Mrs. Snagsby, at what time did you expect Mr. and Mrs. Chadband, my love? At 6, says Mrs. Snagsby. Mr. Snagsby observes in a mild and casual way that it's gone that. Perhaps you'd like to begin without them, is Mrs. Snagsby's reproachful remark. Mr. Snagsby does look as if he would like it very much, but he says, with his cough of mildness, no, my dear, no. I merely name the time. What's time, says Mrs. Snagsby, to eternity. Very true, my dear, says Mr. Snagsby. Only when a person lays in victuals for tea, a person does it with a view perhaps more to time. And when a time is named for having tea, it's better to come up to it. To come up to it. Mrs. Snagsby repeats with severity. Up to it. As if Mr. Chadband was a fighter. Not at all, my dear, says Mr. Snagsby. He hear, Guster, who had been looking out of the bedroom window, comes rustling and scratching down the little staircase like a popular ghost, and falling flushed into the drawing room, announces that Mr. and Mrs. Chadband have appeared in the court. The bell at the inner door in the passage immediately thereafter tinkling, she is admonished by Mrs. Snagsby, on pain of instant reconsignment to her patron saint, not to omit the ceremony of announcement. Much discomposed in her nerves, which were previously in the best order, by this threat, she so fearfully mutilates that point of state, as to announce Mr. and Mrs. Cheeseeming, least which, imminter say, what's her name, and retires conscience stricken from the presence. Mr. Chadband is a large yellow man with a fat smile, and a general appearance of having a good deal of train oil in his system. Mrs. Chadband is a stern, severe-looking, silent woman. Mr. Chadband moves softly and cumbrously, not unlike a bear who has been taught to walk upright. He is very much embarrassed about the arms, as if they were inconvenient to him, and he wanted to grovel, is very much in a perspiration about the head, and never speaks without first putting up his great hand, as delivering a token to his hearers, that he is going to edify them. My friends, says Mr. Chadband, peace be on this house, on the master thereof, on the mistress thereof, on the young maidens, and on the young men. My friends, why do I wish for peace? What is peace? Is it war? No. Is it strife? No. Is it lovely, and gentle, and beautiful, and pleasant, and serene, and joyful? Oh, yes. Therefore, my friends, I wish for peace, upon you and upon yours. In consequence of Mrs. Snagsby looking deeply edified, Mr. Snagsby thinks it expedient on the whole to say amen, which is well received. Now, my friends, proceeds Mr. Chadband, since I am upon this theme, Guster presents herself. Mrs. Snagsby, in a spectral bass voice, and without removing her eyes from Chadband, says with dreadful distinctness, go away. Now, my friends, says Chadband, since I am upon this theme, and in my lowly path am proving it, Guster is heard unaccountably, to murmur 1782. The spectral voice repeats more solemnly, go away. Now, my friends, says Mr. Chadband, we will inquire in a spirit of love, still Guster reiterates 1782. Mr. Chadband, pausing with the resignation of a man accustomed to be persecuted, and languidly folding up his chin into his fat smile, says, let us hear the maiden. Speak, maiden. 1782, if you please, sir. Which he wished to know what the shilling were for, says Guster, breathless. For? Returns Mrs. Chadband. For his fare. Guster replied that he insists on 1 8 pence, or on some ounces in the party. Mrs. Snagsby and Mrs. Chadband are proceeding to grow shrill in indignation, when Mr. Chadband quiets the tumult by lifting up his hand. My friends, says he, I remember a duty unfulfilled yesterday. It is right that I should be chastened in some penalty. I ought not to murmur. Rachel, pay the 8 pence. While Mrs. Snagsby, drawing her breath, looks hard at Mr. Snagsby, as who should say, you hear this apostle? And while Mr. Chadband glows with humility and train oil, Mrs. Chadband pays the money. It is Mr. Chadband's habit, it is the head and front of his pretensions indeed, to keep this sort of debtor and creditor account in the smallest items, and to post it publicly on the most trivial occasions. My friends, says Chadband, 8 pence is not much. It might justly have been 1 4 pence. It might justly have been 1/2 crown. Oh, let us be joyful, joyful. Oh, let us be joyful. With which remark, which appears from its sound to be an extract in verse, Mr. Chadband stalks to the table, and before taking a chair, lifts up his admonitory hand. My friends, says he, what is this which we now behold as being spread before us? Refreshment. Do we need refreshment then, my friends? We do. And why do we need refreshment, my friends? because we are but mortal, because we are but sinful, because we are but of the earth, because we are not of the air. Can we fly, my friends? We cannot. Why can we not fly, my friends? Mr. Snagsby, presuming on the success of his last point, ventures to observe in a cheerful and rather knowing tone, no wings, but is immediately frowned down by Mrs. Snagsby. I say, my friends, pursues Mr. Chadband, utterly rejecting and obliterating Mr. Snagsby's suggestion, why can we not fly? Is it because we are calculated to walk? It is. Could we walk, my friends, without strength? We could not. What should we do without strength, my friends? Our legs would refuse to bear us, our knees would double up, our ankles would turn over, and we should come to the ground. Then from whence, my friends, in a human point of view, do we derive the strength that is necessary to our limbs? Is it, says Chadband, glancing over the table, from bread in various forms, from butter which is churned, from the milk which is yielded unto us by the cow, from the eggs which are laid by the fowl, from ham, from tongue, from sausage, and from such like? It is. Then let us partake of the good things which are set before us. The persecutors denied that there was any particular gift in Mr. Chadband's piling verbose flights of stairs, one upon another, after this fashion. But this can only be received as a proof of their determination to persecute, since it must be within everybody's experience that the Chadband style of oratory is widely received and much admired. Mr. Chadband, however, having concluded for the present, sits down at Mr. Snagsby's table and lays about him prodigiously. The conversion of nutriment of any sort into oil of the quality already mentioned appears to be a process so inseparable from the constitution of this exemplary vessel that in beginning to eat and drink, he may be described as always becoming a kind of considerable oil mills, or other large factory for the production of that article on a wholesale scale. On the present evening of the long vacation, in Cook's Court, Cursitor Street, he does such a powerful stroke of business that the warehouse appears to be quite full when the works cease. At this period of the entertainment, Guster, who has never recovered her first failure, but has neglected no possibler. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.